evidently maybe not Seattle.
And always next to a major highway off-ramp.
Sorry?
Always next to a major highway off-ramp.
Always next to a major highway off-ramp, and you've got no clue what city you're in.
Right.
Or what environment you're in. They're all identical.
It's kind of like when you go to an airport.
How do you know, once you get on the concourse, how do you know what airport you're in? I'm always happy when I get on the D concourse in Chicago because the dinosaur makes me know I'm in Chicago. If I'm not in the D concourse, I'm not sure I was ever in O'Hare. Okay? But one airport is the same. McDonald's are roughly the same whether you're in Germany or South Korea or Fort Worth, right? Non-places. Now, Augay's point is that non-places create non-people. Central to our human identity, our self-formation, is identity with a place. So, who are my farm kids again? All right? I mean, I will always be a farm boy. And about 5 years ago, after my mother died, we sold the farm, and I have not forgiven myself since.
Right.
Because the jerk who bought it just... it's not the same place anymore.
Right.
It's not my place anymore. It was a family farm for three generations. Our self-identity is tied to specific environments. An interesting medieval theologian, Duns Scotus, develops the idea that we only know God through specific places. So we had on our list of formative things a church. Your way of thinking about God is probably in some way shaped by the structure of the physical structure of the church. Let me tell you how that did that for me. As a little kid, actually probably until after, I don't think they fixed it until well after I graduated from college, there was a water spot up in the, there's the altar up in the top right corner of the ceiling. There was a water spot that looked like a face. And I can remember as a little 4 or 5 year old looking up there and thinking God was watching us as we worshiped. And that has stayed with me. When we gather to worship, I cannot but look for some sort of place where God's hiding, watching us. I don't know whether that's always good or bad, but that's a way in which that gets to me. And it's about that very specific church building. I want us to come back to church buildings. So this whole idea of non-places. But non-places spark resistance. So Michel de Certeau, another French thinker, talks about the way in which society tells us this space is reserved for activity X, but people figure out ways to undercut that. So I've noticed that the children don't read the stay off the grass signs. Okay, so Holden is attempting to create an off-limits space, and I understand, get the grass growing, but the little kids are just, to heck with that. So in New York City, people playing in the street where they have rules. You know, drivers slow down when they see kids. The kids move off. They know how to come back and pick up the football game where it was once the driver has passed. But that's an undercutting of the social definition of the space. If I sit next to the window in a Cracker Barrel in order to look out and see some, hopefully, maybe some scenery somewhere, I'm sort of undercutting what they're hoping I will do. Street people who sleep on heat exhausts from buildings are violating the social construction of the space. So there are these ways in which we can resist what's been forced on us by previous definitions. So back to your small groups. I want you to, I need to set this up a little better. Buildings, people, relationship to the environment. What kind of people do we need? What are the qualities of the kind of people we need in the next generation? Get together and make a list of qualities that you want to see in your grandchildren or your children. Let's see what we've come up with. How many of you have grandkids?
Kids.
Yeah,
can't be plural.
Grandkid. How many of you hope to have grandkids someday? Okay. So what do you want these people to be like?
There we go. You want to relate. How many?
Give me two or three and then give them a chance.
Generous, flexible.
Generous, flexible. That's good.
Ecologically minded.
We had compassion or compassionate.
Good one.
The capacity to protest. Tied to awareness of...
So that ties into the one you were talking about being politically involved.
Right, we had politically involved, right. And we had the / power. We wanted to, realizing that's where the power can come from.
So does that catch your idea, political in a positive way?
I think so. That was yours.
Yeah.
Okay.
Particularly if it involves planning as well as just...
Yeah, clearly urban planning is incredibly important. But if we take a little detour there, what's the problem with current urban planning? It's nearly all dictated by corporate interests rather than, you were talking about local communities. Mm-hmm. So really we want everybody to be from Vermont. A couple more from your list.
Think globally, act locally.
So I'm going to turn it around. Act at the local level so that it has a positive global impact.
Yeah, and actually that's what he said. And we just, yeah.
But the sound bite is act locally, think globally.
Right.
Anything else?
Responsibility or responsible.
Ah.
And tied to that would be an awareness of one's impact related to consumption, so how providing for my needs impacts neighbor.
Interdependence.
Yeah.
Okay. Awareness.
You want awareness of interconnectedness.
Yeah.
Is that right? Interconnected. Yeah. Boy, that's a long word. Okay.
So we've got, I think, through one, three of them we could kind of group together. Critical thinkers, inventive, and creative. Hmm. They're all kind of similar.
Inventive. Okay. Now, nearly all of these are relational concepts. The interconnected idea. So what it is we have to overcome to achieve this is we have to overcome dualistic thinking. Thinking in oppositions. Here I am just incredibly helped by ecofeminism. In ecofeminism, one of the things, dualism or dualistic thinking is the sin superior of patriarchy. Or what Elizabeth Schuster-Fiorenza has come to call kyriarchy, in which we have a system of lords and vassals up and down through everything. In dualistic thinking, some of the classic dualisms are man versus nature, and I'm specifically using man there because it's the male human who goes out and conquers female nature. So notice that we use female language to describe the natural world or the planet, and we tend to use male language to describe subduing and getting that Earth Mother out there in her place and keeping her in her place. So if I'm an ecofeminist, we've got to overcome that dualism. Male-female is another dualism. the civilized versus the wild is a classic dualism that's been with us for about 4,000 to 5,000 years now. We want to go out and civilize that wild country. We want to civilize those savage natives, sort of thing. Another one is the dualism between city and village or the rural, in which the city is the preferred value, much in terms of the classic definitions that we've been working with, and those poor country bumpkins out there who are just trapped in their little whatever it is. We've got to raise them up to the level of us cultured city folk. So we need to overcome that. Now, think of the way... All right, I've got a project again I want you to get going on, so I'm trying to get it unpacked here. 4 semesters ago, I had a young woman from the Bronx. And in my Intro to Religious Studies class, at the end of the semester, there is an assignment called The Meditation on Grass, provided my shipment from Washington State gets in. No. What they have to do is they have to go outside, they have to find roughly a sort of square yard of grass, sit down, and focus on nothing but the grass with their whole being, mental, spiritual, physical, focus on the experience of grass for 30 minutes, and then they have to come in and write about it. This young woman came to me and said, I'm really nervous about this because I'm afraid of grass. She'd grown up, coming to Seelands Grove was her first foray out of the five boroughs. Her idea of what was normal is concrete and streets and maybe little tiny patches of grass, but you don't go there because who knows what's going to happen to you. Something's going to come out of the grass and eat you. My wife told me a story about our dean of students, a New Yorker, who our provost took for a hike in the Pennsylvania woods. And the further they got out of Seelands Grove, and the closer they got up into what Pennsylvanians call mountains, and actually started the hike up into the forest, this woman was just nuts, totally out of her comfort zone. She had no idea how to relax into a hike through the woods. Two people shaped by a human-built environment. All right, if you want this kind of person, how do you change your house? That's your assignment. Remember, you grew up in a home that shaped you. If you want people coming out of New York City or Philadelphia or Dallas with these kinds of values, first assignment is, how would you redesign a home?
More generically speaking, as opposed to like thinking more specific.
Not thinking of your specific, but just generically. How would you redesign the typical American home?
Let's see, there are city codes that would not enable me.
Well, let's imagine we've got the codes taken care of.
You mean the house?
A house.
Okay, a house or a home?
A house or a home?
Either one.
You can play with apartments if you wish.
Well, but it's about the structure, not about
the structure.
How they're raised.
No, this is not about education or school system. This is
or
just about when they're sitting in that space.
Got it.
How does the space impact them differently?
Oh, yes.
Windows.
And this is what you're trying to create. A person who, just by being in that space, will be more like this. So, how are you changing a sort of average American home? Let's start with you guys.
Started with talking about shrinking the average American home. Because they're so huge.
Yeah, we don't need to be building McMansions.
And then...
Can I play with that one for
sure,
a little
bit? Sure, go for it.
How does that change the person? If you grow up in a mansion or you grow up in a smaller space, what's the difference?
I think the larger space for an average, you know, whatever family of four is, everything's individualized. I have my own space. You're not watching the program I want to watch. I'm going to go to the other living room to watch whatever. Now it's all device driven, but it's just there's lots of not independence, but individuality, and not as much intersection or sharing of space.
If our goal is interconnected, mm-hmm. The starting point is just interconnectedness with one another, mm-hmm. and the larger square footage home begins to create this sort of hyper-individualism that's not about sharing, not about compromise, not about knowing each other in that sense, which happens in a smaller, tighter space. Good one. Yeah. Go for another.
We went outside pretty quick and talked about removing fences, talked a bit about gated community, not allowing gated communities, that kind of concept where there's an exclusivity.
Not having fences between
yards? Yeah, definition of like sort of what's mine and what's yours and entitlement of space.
And the idea of having kind of more fluid share things, like right? So that you know, it's more fluid, sort of publicly defined. Like now, you know, like where I come from LA, right? Everyone's gonna have their own swimming pool, which is ridiculous in essentially a desert area, right? And so
more fluidity of shared public spaces, which gets where did that come from? Oh, my statement about Vermont, which gets us back to the political engagement, which is rooted in people who live together, work together, know each other, and are capable of making decisions for their local community in a way that if we're fencing ourselves off and gating ourselves off, we begin to lose that public discourse about what is the common good, and it's only what's my good, what's best for my property. What's best for my particular situation rather than what's good for all of us.
Are you really from LA? Do you share lawnmowers?
Oh, I don't live there anymore.
Oh.
No, we don't. No.
So let's get a couple from you guys now.
Okay, a place and home to be creative and to problem solve. For example, woodworking, sewing, place to just be able to leave the creativity and come back to it.
So crafts and skills located in the home rather than going out. So rather than getting in your car and driving to some sort of craft thingy, and that might be multi-generational, a way in which you think of multi-generational living, in which traditionally the older, that's not me yet, the older people teach the younger people crafts across generations and things like that. That's a great one. What else?
Concept of the structure, you continue to create and build onto the structure. You might build on a porch. You might build, so there's continual growth of the house changing and becoming a better fit for the family, if that makes sense. So the ongoing renovation or building of a structure.
You do it together. It's not done by a contractor.
So ongoing remodeling according to the way in which needs change.
Right, yeah.
Wow, which is really going to make a difference in terms of how you think about the design of the structure so that it would be open to that. Where's a load-bearing wall that you can or cannot take out, and all of those sorts of things come into a piece of it. Back to you guys.
Sensitivity to materials put into the home, so both in where materials come from and environmental sensitivity to that.
So let's tie those two together.
Mm-hmm.
On this one, you've got this idea of a multi-generational group working at changing the home. Who's doing the work here for you? If we're more involved in our own construction in terms of looking at what materials am I using rather than a contractor or, you know, just walking into it, I mean, the typical American home represents a huge concentration of toxic materials. If I'm doing the work, I'm going to be much more, or I'm at least involved in the work. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be much more concerned about the toxicity of the stuff I'm putting into my home. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great.
And then also in terms of how it's made, levels of efficiency, heating and cooling and water consumption and things like that. So in ongoing usage, how am I?
I heard you guys talking about that. If I want my kids to be concerned about efficiency, there's some sort of way in which I need to involve them in paying the electric bill in terms of thinking about their responsibility for the heating and cooling costs.
Yeah.
So that they grow up thinking about, rather than just, oh man, I lived 20 years of my life, never had to think or worry about the electric bill, and then all of a sudden I start getting it. Where are my parents when I need them?
Yeah, we talk about it in my home.
Yeah. But again, it's about that involvement. Mm-hmm. Okay, another one from you guys.
So big enough so that others can be invited in. So there's room enough to allow others to be invited into this home. Yeah.
Entertaining.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd like to add on there the idea that orientation of the building, not just smaller footprint, but rather than building warehouse boxes, you build a community with a cul-de-sac or something.
You're thinking about, well, you're not thinking about it just like I've got this little space that I can do whatever I want. You're thinking about how does that space relate to all the other spaces around it.
All you have to do is fly in over any kind of a city and see the development over a period of years, how they designed, used the geography, or just they're built for the sake of a box to put people in.
Okay, I've got some ideas I'm going to add that I hope will spark some thinking. Norman Weersbaugh suggests that the single greatest thing we can do for the planet is for every single one of us to become gardeners.
We did have green spaces around the house.
Well, not just green spaces, garden.
Yeah.
In my environmental ethics class, the first week of the semester, the students are required to go to Lowe's, is our little place, and buy a plant. And they have to have the plant still be alive at the end of the semester.
Yeah.
That's a graded assignment. They have to reflect on that. And mostly what they write up is that eventually their plant got a name, Herbie or Sally or, whatever, oftentimes they kill one and have to buy another one and start over again, and they feel horrible that they murdered the first plant. But they learn from it because the second one they actually bothered to look up what does it need? What kind of soil should it be in? One young woman wrote about her father's big into gardening, and when he heard about the assignment, he just loved me to death, even though he didn't know me, because she was. And then they shared the experience of caring for this plant through her semester, and she learned about plants from her father. So, bay windows, where you can do a flower. Or you can do an herb garden in a bay window. In my own home, if we ever redo the windows again, I've got some really nice sort of southwest-facing windows on one side, and put in a couple of big bays in there and have a year-round herbal garden, and then another place just with plants. But some way in which we care for that. For us, particularly for us guys, this means ending once and for all the who's got the greenest lawn competition. It means using no herbicides, no pesticides on the lawn. It probably means rather than having big manicured lawn, a lot of it is, we're thinking about how to do bird habitat or garden, something that's productive. So that my family, I planted kale this year And I can't believe how much better it tastes than the stuff I used to buy in the store. I mean, I've just been, the salads have been amazing. So if your family, if your kids are involved in producing some of their own food that they sit down at the table and eat. I'm deeply influenced by Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma. And one of the things that was true, particularly for us who grow up on the farm, we knew the animal we were eating. It was a friend, and now it's a hamburger.
We couldn't name them.
Yep.
We were forbidden to name those
right.
animals.
Well, right. I named it, even though my parents told me not to. Come on. Mom, you're going to tell me not to name the calf. Okay, Fred, she doesn't want you to have a name.
What you're saying and what we're supposed to say and what I've heard people like Wendell Berry say is just the engagement. It doesn't have to be this grand scale half-acre garden. Just the simple engagement of these
because
small
of,
things are growing a carrot that then you make the connection back to like, where's my food coming from? How do things
because
grow?
If I'm in Manhattan in an apartment,
yeah.
If the apartment is designed with a bay window, it might not be much, but I can grow something.
Mm-hmm.
And that just that little bit of engagement makes me more sensitive to the way in which a place like Holden is being treated
mm-hmm.
or preserved. I'm aware of the issues. The other thing that you can, we've sort of transitioned here, but the other thing that you can do, particularly in an urban, I mean, we need to be thinking about urban farming, which means you can raise chickens on most of Manhattan's roofs, or you can put rooftop gardens on them. There's a totally new design that the Chinese actually came up, which are vertical forests in which a skyscraper has trees growing out the side, which completely revolutionizes, first of all, the look of the building and the way in which what people are expecting to see and experience, but also revolutionizes the atmosphere. Vacant lots for farming. Urban farmers. If cities were to start zoning out private automobiles, you got all sorts of parking garages that can be turned into small farms, multi-level farms. And once you start changing urban areas in terms of particularly food production, gardening, urban farming, you change that city's relationship to the rural environment, because currently cities suck in factory-produced food that the people who consume it in the city have no clue where it came from, how it was raised, they're disconnected. If a city is starting to produce a good deal, it can't produce all, that frees rural areas to move away from factory farming and to preserve more of their environment. Even perhaps to restore more wild areas. The other thing that I think is significant is the role of pets. If caring for a plant can help, caring for and meeting the needs of a pet can be a positive in terms of understanding relationship. Here, I think one of the most important things, at least from my perspective as a theologian, is that caring for a pet helps us learn to deal with death. Because there are virtually no pets other than, what are those turtles that live to be 200 years old? That are going to outlive you. The average pet is going to die. And then as a family, you begin to teach basically the Lion King. And a cycle of life, and to experience that as a positive. One of the things that I think is dangerous for our culture is the Disneyfication of nature. So that children begin to think of animals as Disney characters rather than actual animals. And I mean, tied to that is the way in which the typical vacation idea for an American family is something like Disneyland rather than Holden. The number of people going to national parks continues to decline while the number of people going to Epcot and Disney World climbs. And so that we build more of these controlled environment sorts of places, which increase the disconnect. So any way that we can redesign features to build that connection. So here's your final assignment. The church. The church building ought to be a place where our spiritual lives are connected to the natural world. How do you change your church? It sounds like you're being pretty productive, so we're a small group. Let's come back in and see what you're coming up with. I'm going to make a couple of suggestions. One of the things is, as Christians, and we're thinking here specifically in that tradition, we've got some really positive things to draw on in terms of theology of the sacraments and the whole idea, because you have a baptismal font, right? We bring water into, now it's incredibly tamed. There's not much in just a little bowl of water that's going to really connect, so we'll play with that. But in the idea of the sacraments, that through physical things, God comes to us. You guys were talking about baking the bread in the church and the smell was there during the service. That's a rich tradition to draw on. Now, normally, however, churches, in part because most of our churches in our area, how many of you are Lutheran or some sort of mainline Northern European Protestant?
Sure.
Because of the adverse weather across the northern tier of the states and northern Europe, so our idea of what a church should look like comes from the Europeans, it's about keeping nature out. So that you can try to be somewhat warm
and dry.
Yeah, there is that. So normally all we get altar flowers, we get a baptismal font with a little tiny bit of water in it, and then we might have stained glass filtering the light. Now, I'm a Lutheran pastor in addition to a college professor, so I do a lot of pulpit supply on weekends, and I am shocked. And how many churches are designed with no windows? Mm-hmm. There's you're in there, you're in a box.
Classrooms are done that way.
Yeah, until the end of the service when you finally get out. So share with me some of the ideas you had.
Well, I talk about that because I'm a pastor and our sanctuary drives me bananas because there's no direct connection with outside. Contrasted with a monastery nearby where they just redid their chapel and it's beautiful. They both harvested local timber and then their windows are amazing. I mean, you literally look beyond the altar and look into the forest and nature and it's like, wow, these guys got it right. So just things like that, whereas you're worshiping, even if you have to be sheltered and warm and dry, there's still a connection with things that are more natural.
So if God is light, and the light came into the world, then let's bring light into our sanctuaries, which is probably going to mean rather than the stained glass, which is it's light, but it gets very anthropocentric. We just got windows so that you can look out. On that connection, as a piece of a final assignment in my environmental ethics class, students have to design a worship space. Mm-hmm. And the last couple of semesters, what they found online is a church in the Ozarks in which there's just a frame and everything else is glass. Even a huge part of the roof is glass. So that it's like sitting outside for a worship service at camp, except that it can protect you from the wind and it can protect you from the rain. It's beautiful.
I've been there, but the Iona community has a topless
just
sanctuary.
Open. Yeah.
It's just open to the world.
Which in a Scottish winter, you sort of wonder about, right?
So we have a church that's in an urban area, so it's not very pretty outside our building, so that instead of, that we do have gardens outside our building that invite people by.
So in the church grounds, you're doing gardening?
We do gardening. We do a lot of gardening. Dan and I are part of that group, and we keep them beautiful. And
so as a pastor, I wonder, why not dig up some space around the altar and have a tree? Have some things growing.
Well, we do palms. We have palms that people bring in big pots, and so we do have those.
It's doing it in sort of a potted sense,
yes,
rather.
Yes, in a potted sense.
I've seen congregations where I've sort of wondered, you know, there's often a space behind the altar, which is already kind of an alcove out into the world. Why not just dig that up, put a sort of greenhouse around it, and just have stuff growing? We could do the potted thing all through the sanctuary. Of course, you're going to have enough window to get light in to keep this stuff alive, but there would be a way to do that. Anything else?
We had, you know, this community that belongs to this lady here, they bring in all their excess garden produce, and they bring that to the church.
Yeah.
And I was suggesting, I mean, there are a lot of churches that do this, that it'll often be out in the foyer. Bring that to the altar. Have it there during the worship service where it gains a sanctity and a sort of overflow of grace. And then the people who share it come up and receive from that center of grace, tying the produce to the graciousness of God, which seems to me as though it would be really powerful.
I have a pastor friend who is, I think she's in her fifth interim right now, but she has engaged the children wherever she's been in a bucket for the money, but in their choosing a project around the world or somewhere outside of the community so that she directly connects them as church and as worship with somebody somewhere else in the world.
So deciding what it is we're involved in terms of ministry can build those connections. Can we think of the one that, of course, is the most difficult for us is animals. It's easy. Notice that everything we've talked about so far has largely been about fauna. Flora.
Flora.
And we haven't talked a lot about the need for, I mean, we talked about pets, but are there ways, the animals are the ones that are most in danger. 60% of all the world's species are under stress. It's a huge number, grows every year toward extinction or in danger of extinction. Rethinking the city, rethinking a city in the Northwest so that it can live with bears. Rethinking a city in the Midwest so that the deer aren't all mowed down on the freeway. And they can come into your yard. You're going to have to protect your garden, but how do we bring megafauna back into this picture, which are the ones that are most in danger of extinction? I know of churches that do, you know, a day you bless your pets. Or I saw a church in the Lutheran that had done a, you know, bless your 4-H animals. So people had brought their calves or whatever it was to church for a day. That's clearly a sort of way we could go with it. I played with, what would it be like to design a sort of aviary up in the peak of the roof?
I don't think it's good to bring birds.
So that might not work that well, but
bird lovers
can
say no.
Okay. Yeah, because birds don't have, what is that famous Garrison Keillor line? Birds do not have a sphincter muscle, which Well, how does he say that? It's in a riff about third grade, and third graders are just amazed by the fact that birds don't have sphincter muscles. But are there ways in which, you know, somehow, with St. Francis, we preach to the rabbits and the squirrels, as well as to people. We preach to the birds. I struggle with, both in terms of how do we redesign urban and suburban spaces.
Our gardens bring in birds at our church.
Well, and my sister-in-law who lives in Portland, they have a program where you can have your yard designated bird sanctuary, and they give you trees and things you're supposed to grow. But how does territory around the church could be...
So if you have plants around the church, then that is a sanctuary for bird life, and would be rabbits, whatever is in the community.
You just have to put out 100 hosta plants and we'd have 200 deer.
That's right.
Because that's their salad and their dessert, yes?
Yeah. We'd have 600 slugs.
One of the things that I think about is... is there a way in which we redesign our churches so that we have, during inclement weather, indoor worship, and during good weather you can somehow flip the altar and we're out in nature? It would be an interesting design, because at many universities now there are outdoor designed lecture spaces with a sort of auditorium design.
The Krakentotten one.
Yeah. So are there ways in which church can be designed so that, you know, in January, we're inside and it's warm, but in August we flip the altar and there's this exterior worship space where we're in the open and experiencing God's creation.
It occurs to me one thing we haven't mentioned is the lectionary. And I think about...
That's great.
I think about how that was formed irrespective of what we're talking about.
it was formed without a lot of thought to a lot of things we think about.
Yes.
Yeah, well, here we've talked earlier this morning about at least occasionally singing a hymn of lament. And the ELW now does have a couple lament hymns in it. But as much as I like him, I suppose all of you know the name of David Luce, but he never gets off the gospel. Mm. And consequently, both the gospel and his sort of psychological orientation, I think, dominates the preaching in the church.
Yeah.
And we need more variety.
That is a professional hazard for us pastors, is to become Marcionites.
That's right.
And only preach the gospel and never anything else, or the gospel text. But you're right. The lectionary avoids a whole lot of difficult texts. My wife focuses a lot of her research on... some of the more problematic sexual stories, those never show up, never get dealt with in terms of the life of the church. And many of there are seven different accounts of creation in the Hebrew Bible. And really only the first one hardly ever shows up in the lectionary, sometimes the second one, but very focused usually on just Adam.
We could return to those Ember days or Rogation days, and focusing on old Saint Isidore and all the other things that have sort of dropped out in the Catholic Church with because we added all this other stuff. But that was good stuff.
Yeah, or more about Saint Francis.
Well, yeah, we sing a lot of him.
That whole brother, son, sister, moon thing. I think there are ways in which the church can be more proactively involved in shaping a new generation to see the spirituality of nature, the connection to nature. But it might take some politics to get that changed in different places. We are over time. I know probably some of you want to get to Glenn's thing that's going to start next door. So thank you very much.